From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made yesterday morning when NPR made an announcement about online comments. They are going away permanently. NPR has found that most of the community engagement is now happening on other platforms, so this seemed like the move that made the most sense. But the announcement did spark some backlash from longtime news commenters, and it has opened a discussion about audience feedback and interaction. Should news sites keep comment sections open? In fact, do they have an obligation to do that? Should they be moderated? Are there better ways to do it? We'd love to hear from you this hour. And let me go ahead and welcome our guests as we discuss audience engagement. We've got two people in studio who do exactly that. Julie Phillip is the senior engagement editor for The Democrat and Chronicle. Julie, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Seth Palmer is digital content manager at 13WAM. Seth, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Howard Owens is on the phone with us. He's the publisher of the Batavian and the Wyoming County Free Press. Howard, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Evan. Great to be here.
I'll start with you, Howard, because you were one of the first people to react online that I knew what you were going to say before you said it, because you have for a long time said this is an important way to stay in touch with the community, and you think this was the wrong move, yes?
Well, absolutely. You know, I look at this as like a whole business aspect. We're all struggling for revenue. The way we all make revenue is through audience, and when we start ceding control of that audience to the platforms, whether it's giving all of our content to the platforms or letting them dominate the conversation, instead of building tools that better engage our audience, then we're giving away the future of our business.
Howard, you're the publisher of the Batavian and the Wyoming County Free Press, and so your policy is what, and what will it continue to be?
So it's what it's been all along, and it's been very successful for us. I should point out that, and I mentioned this to you, I think, in an email, you can't name a hot button topic that we have discussed on the Batavian in a civil manner, be it abortion, gay rights, racial issues, everything at one time or another has come up on the Batavian, and we've done it without flame wars. That's because we have a real name policy, we enforce it, and we don't allow trolls, we don't allow personal insults, particularly like really over-the-top personal insults. Monitor heavily, I participate in the conversations a lot of the times, and the real name policy is important. A lot of people misunderstand that. There's lots of studies out there that'll show you, and anybody that's had a lot of time on Facebook knows it's true, people can still be jerks under their real name.
Yes.
The advantage of the real name policy is it's a way to get rid of bad actors. Once we ban somebody, they're gone. With the real name policy, it's virtually impossible for them to get back on the site. And that just helps keep the conversation clean.
I will say this, Howard. When the conversation started to organically move toward Facebook, for example, and these kind of platforms where you do have not only a name but sometimes a picture, I did think, well, this will definitely increase the civil nature of the discourse. And boy, people will still surprise you, even when they're using their real name. But
some of the worst comments I've seen in my life have been on our own stories on Facebook. We have the power to moderate on Facebook, but I figure that's Mark Zuckerberg's job, not mine. So we have a mostly hands-off policy to people commenting on Facebook, and the cruelty, the inhumanity to man that comes up sometimes is astonishing.
Julie Phillips, senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. I'd like to get your organization's policy, what you expect that to be, and your thoughts on NPR's decision.
Okay. Well, I fully understand what NPR is saying. Last year, we had 97% of our comments took place on social media, on Facebook, not on our site. So only 3% of the comments are actually made on our site. And we do police our social media accounts very heavily, just as we would our site. We think it's important to try to maintain some sort of civility and, good conversation happening on social media as well as our own site. But it is a lot of work. And so while I agree that it is important to have conversation, I don't think that we should close out that conversation. I understand why they're moving toward this approach.
Okay. Seth Palmer, who is the digital content manager at 13WAM, your thoughts on your company's policy?
Our policy is fairly similar to that of the Batavian, where you can have your discourse, you can have the conversation, but you have to remain respectful, you have to remain civil, and you have to refrain from personal attacks. And we do our best to keep that in check. It can be difficult, as anybody who knows who's gone onto a news site's Facebook page. I know Julie probably has the same issues as we do with people unfortunately creating fake accounts so that they can troll, so that they can spew their left-wing, right-wing, what have you, comments. And that can be difficult to deal with. But I think there is part of the conversation that hasn't been talked about yet is it being a little bit easier, a little bit more simplistic to have an existing account that you can go into and you can like several pages in your feed and then you can comment on something. And I think that's more of an engagement tool that people can just go on and they can comment on something quickly as opposed to having to create multiple steps for a login.
Yeah, and Seth, I know your company has a remarkable number of Facebook fans, for example.
Yes.
The most of the local media in town, and I know that's that is something that has been a priority for your company. You've been very successful at that, so you get a huge amount of Facebook interaction. So when NPR says, look, we're not taking the comments section away because we don't want interaction, we're just recognizing it's already moved. We didn't choose that. Do you at least appreciate that notion?
I do, and it's unfortunate because when you're moving from one form of media to another, just as the evolution of the conversation progresses, you are going to have some people who are going to feel that loss of the community, which is unfortunate, but they can migrate to the new section, which is, you know, not always what everybody wants to hear. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel that loss. Yeah,
but to Howard's point, yep. You know, it'd be great if we had effective tools for our own sites to have the conversation there. But and there are a lot of experiments out there, people trying to build different types of engagement tools. But so far, I haven't seen anything that's really, you know, practical for us to put on our own sites to take back that conversation from social media.
Howard, when it comes to that point from NPR, I want to get your take on this, and then I'm going to open it up to some of what our listeners are already weighing in on. Many of them on Twitter, by the way, some of them on Facebook, but we're getting engagement already online. But you can follow the conversation there at Evan Dawson, or you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, it's 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Do you use online comment sections? Do you only go there when you want to be depressed? How do you use them? But Howard, you know, let me just read a few things here and get your take on this, because what NPR is saying, you know, what Julie Phillip just said, you know, 97% of the DNC comments happened not on democratandchronicle.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
NPR is saying essentially the same here, Howard. So let me go ahead and read from the article on NPR.org yesterday. When NPR analyzed the number of people who left at least one comment in both June and July, the number showed an even more interesting pattern. Just 4,300 users posted about 145 comments apiece, or about 67% of all NPR.org comments for those 2 months. More than half of all comments in May, June, and July combined came from a mere 2,600 users. The conclusion, NPR's commenting system, which gets more expensive the more comments that are posted, and in some months has cost NPR twice what was budgeted, is serving a very, very small slice of its overall audience. It's not possible to tell who those commenters are. Some users comment anonymously. But the bottom line is NPR finds it's just such a small number that they're not being well served there, and it's not a good ROI. So does it make sense, Howard, to say, look, 10 years ago, this would be a more valid criticism, but that conversation moved on its own, and NPR, you know, it's hard to blame them for just recognizing that.
Great. I'm going to try to make three really quick
sure.
points, and if you want to delve in on anything later, we can. So real quickly, first of all, I think distributed conversation, like you alluded to at the just a few minutes ago, that's going on right now with this conversation, I'm not against that. I think that's a great thing. About the point about limited engagement, NPR said only 1% of their users are commenting. Apparently, and not to sound too insulting, but apparently the folks at NPR have never heard the 1% rule. And you can look this up in Google. There's a Wikipedia entry. This goes back to bulletin boards, sites like The Well back in the 70s and 80s on, really more in the 80s. all the way up through discussion boards and email lists, everything that's evolved on the web over time, even Wikipedia itself. Only 1% of your audience is actively engaged in any online community. That's been a truism throughout the digital age. So the fact that they have only 1% is normal. It's not below average or anything like that. But yes, in we're experiencing this with the Batavian too. We're losing a lot of the conversation that we used to get on our site to social media. It's frustrating. I think there are multiple reasons for that. Part of it is an ongoing frustration I have throughout my career, the inability to have tools that create basically our own social networks. At each of my previous employers, I tried to get the resources to build tools that would have essentially been kind of like our own Facebook, for lack of a better metaphor, quickly, welded right into our news sites. We should have had that kind of engagement on our news sites 15 years ago, and nobody wanted to make that investment. What's happening with NPR is really a microcosm of what's been going on in this industry as long as I've been involved in it, and that goes back to 1995, failure to invest in technology that really engages audiences.
But Howard, I just want to follow up on one point, which is you use the term frustrating that you know, you've thought about building and maintaining this interaction on the Batavian's own site, and you've watched a lot of that conversation, as other sites have, move to social media. You called that frustrating, but I think, from what I read of you, you are a let-the-market-decide kind of guy. And if the market is deciding that, why is that frustrating?
Well, it's frustrating because I don't have the resources to invest in the tools I wish I had to compete fairly evenly with Facebook. So, yes, the market's deciding. That's because I've offered an inadequate solution. That's my lack of resources. NPR does not lack resources. The Washington Post, the New York Times, Gannett, Tronk, as they now call themselves, do not lack resources. They could have built the kind of tools that really engage audiences, and they haven't made the investment.
Congratulations, Howard. You're the first person to say Tronk without giggling. I mean, that's...
I thought I said it nasty enough, but...
Yeah. So, all right. So, let me also ask our panelists in studio to respond to something Howard said about real name policy. Mm-hmm. NPR, in their decision to go away from online comments, is referencing the fact that sometimes these anonymous commenters are hard to sort of track. You don't know how many. There's a lot you don't know about them. But Howard has said, look, get tough. Require a real name, and that doesn't guarantee civility, but it helps in many ways. Julie, do you agree?
Yes. We have always, not necessarily a real name, but it has to be a real Facebook account. You can't have a fake one, and it is one of my great pleasures each week to go in and weed out the fake ones, because those tend to be, not always, sometimes the fake ones are civil, but largely they're not, and they come back. You get rid of them, and you can recognize the tone, the voice coming back as another fake account. So it definitely makes a difference, but as you've pointed out, that doesn't mean that all conversation is civil, even when you have a real account. So there is still a lot of monitoring, making sure they're following the rules.
Okay. Seth Palmer?
I would agree with Julie. It's, the having a real name on Facebook doesn't necessarily guarantee civility, and it's unfortunate, but there are some people who are just unafraid of, they even claim that if you'll meet them up in person, you know, meet me in a parking lot somewhere, and I'll continue to say this exact same thing.
I don't believe that for the most part, by the way.
I want to have go ahead, Howard. Real yes. Name policy again. It's because I think it's really important. A lot of news sites miss this. Unless you're using real names as a banning tool, you're going to have people with their real names leaving nasty comments. Mm-hmm. There has to be some teeth behind it. The real names by themselves do not inhibit people.
Right. And I got to say, you know, we envisioned this back when all of this started, this great public square. And for some reason, we all envisioned it to be like the middle of a college campus where we'd have these wonderful discussions. But in real life, we don't like everybody, right? But this sort of forces us to hang out with people we don't like, that they say those things in real life, too. And we would say, well, you know what? I'm not going to hang out with you.
See, I don't like the way you're framing this, though, because there's plenty of people I do like who think very differently than me. I don't
right.
like when they are blank blanks about it.
Right. And but what I'm saying is that just because we're requiring them to have their real name doesn't mean they're changing their personality.
No, I take that point. But I also, you know, Seth bringing up the idea that people have said, look, if I met you in a parking lot, I'd say the same thing. I'd treat you the same way. I go back to what Louis C.K. said about when we are driving our cars, the way we talk to other motorists who obviously can't hear us when we're driving alone in our car, we would never say in an elevator. We would never do that. We are at our actual worst as human beings when we're driving a car, unless we're in the YouTube comment sections, in which we are somehow worse than that.
But
I don't think in person, I really don't think for the most part we do
that. At the corner of Clover and Elmwood one day, somebody actually got out of his car because he was so mad at the driver in front of him who must have cut him off or something and started saying the kinds of things that you say behind the wheel and say you wouldn't say.
Well, that's
people,
road
there
rage.
Are people
like
who do that.
That's the reverse 1% rule. That's that 1% that's going to actually
yeah.
act.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting idea. Go ahead, Howard.
I'll plug an NPR show for you, episode of Invisibilia called The Myth of Personality. They really are on point on this topic. You know, our personalities are very malleable and contingent on the context that we're in. We tend to generally have consistent personalities because we're in consistent contexts. But in the car, online, our personalities can change. And a lot of people don't realize that. And that's one of the things, you know, us as moderators need to take into account. Sometimes the nicest people in the world. And I think there was a story not too long ago about a troll whose wife was shocked to find out he was this online troll. He had a completely different personality online than his wife ever suspected.
It's a good point. And Howard, by the way, what's the name of that Invisibilia episode again?
The Myth of Personality.
Yeah, it's a great show, great point there. Let me read a couple of listener comments. Margaret writes to us and says, I've never commented on a news piece on NPR or any other news site. That being said, I'm not on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or other social sites, and I'm very sad at NPR's decision to eliminate comments. I think it's a poor choice, closing an avenue for public discussion. And she says, by the way, I'm a longtime sustaining NPR member, and that's not going to change. So we're glad to hear that, Margaret. But Margaret weighing in saying, you know, she's not in those other conversation points, and at the very least, that would be one avenue that's now closed to her. But
Evan, can I get on a point on that, too, about the 1% rule? That means most people are lurkers, and I get feedback all the time from people. I never comment, but I love the comments.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting point, too. Sometimes we do measure it only by the commenters, which would probably be a mistake. But Jack writes to us, and Howard, I'll start with you. I'll cue this up as someone who talked about banning people and putting real teeth in real names. Jack writes to us and says, a lot of discussion on your panel about banning people from comment sections, more of an indication that the country is losing its roots in the First Amendment. Okay, Howard, you want to take that?
Sure, because I get that. I've gotten that many times.
I'm sure you have.
You know, and those of us trained in media, whether everybody agrees with it or not, you know, we believe censorship is something the government does. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. The 14th Amendment extends that to all government. And I am not a government agency. I'm a private business in the business of providing a civil place for discussion. That's one of our missions. We want to promote community. We do that through civil discussion. People who want to tear that down hurt our mission and hurt our ability to serve the community. So I'm just not going to tolerate it.
I think that's well said. Seth Palmer, how do you feel about getting tough with people in online sections, occasionally banning, shutting down discourse that you find distasteful?
I think it goes back to one of the things that I've always loved to espouse with this is the freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom from consequences. And so, especially since we're more private entities, we're not a government entity, but if you have a stipulation that says, you know, if you're going to call somebody an idiot on a consistent basis, you're not going to be allowed to say that when the idea behind this platform is to promote discussion or, you know, offer your thoughts on something and trying to elucidate people to a point of view that they might not have otherwise. And we've done the same thing. It's Howard and Julie. We take people off if they're getting too violent with their discourse or making threatening things.
Come on. What if you can prove someone's an idiot?
I would love to hear the qualifications for that because I would certainly qualify in some aspects.
Julie Phillip.
I agree. You know, this is, we don't ban people because of their views. we ban people because of their behavior and the violation of our community rules. So if you're going to promote something illegal, if you're going to attack people, if you're, you know, there are certain levels of discourse that we require. So I don't see this as related to the First Amendment so much as just be nice.
Well, I remember the story of one of the earlier bloggers, Anne Althaus, who is a legal blogger. She married one of her commenters, and she's long had very civil discussion. But at the same time, I know people have wondered, Howard, just how negative it can get. Have you ever had to call police or bring authorities in because of negative, nasty online comments, Howard?
I'm trying to think. There's been a couple of times where I have felt close. As a newsman, not so much because of comments, I've been threatened out on the street. But I can't think of any particular comment that has caused me suspect that there was criminal, there's potential criminal activity.
Okay. Julie Phillip?
Yeah, no, I can't either. There's some that make me shake my head and go, "What? What's happening to this world?" But no, I can't recall anywhere we've had to call in authorities.
Seth?
A couple times. We've had a couple of people privately message us and say threatening things that are more general, but to the point where it's happened repeatedly and we've had to, say, call RPD or Monroe County Sheriff's and say, "Hey, can you just give this person a call and make sure there's not anything really nefarious going on here?" But outside of that, nothing to the point of anyone in the extreme case of banging down our door or anything like that. But just, you know, making threatening statements is something that's not okay for anyone, not just us.
Listeners, we're talking about NPR's decision to eliminate online comments starting next Tuesday. And they say there's a number of reasons for that. We're working through those reasons. The biggest one being that they have seen the conversation and audience interaction migrate to different platforms. Social media, of course, Facebook, Twitter, a few other forms, but NPR.org has become a much smaller base for it. We're talking to Howard Owens, the publisher of the Batavian and the Wyoming County Press, Seth Palmer's digital content manager at 13WAM, Julie Phillip, a senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle, talking about their company's policies, how they handle online interaction. Here's Steve on Twitter who says, "This is a good thing. Let people have their battles in more independent forums. A very small amount of any online commentary is constructive." But Howard, is that too subjective a point to make? I mean, Steve is saying it's not constructive, and I've felt that way many times. I think I agree with the sentiment of his comment, but is that too arbitrary for us to decide, okay, shut it down, no more conversation on this platform?
Well, you know, conversation on our platform has sometimes been trivial, sometimes it's been nonsensical, sometimes it's been very constructive and interesting, and sometimes it's been repetitive because, you know, small community, you get the same people saying the same things a lot of times. But I still think it has value just in existing. We want that form. Every once in a while, somebody still pops up with a good point, and I want to provide that platform. You know, and one thing I should mention, too, the way the Facebook algorithm works, one of the things that frustrates me about people sometimes leaving good comments on Facebook is I'm like, hardly anybody's going to see your comment. The way the algorithm works, your comment's buried. When you comment on the Batavian, we get 12,000, 14,000 people a day to our site. Huge number of those people look at the comments. It's a much bigger platform. And so I want to keep that available to our community.
Okay. Julie Phillip, you want to weigh in there? Go ahead.
Sure. You know, I don't know what NPR is like, but I know a lot of news sites, ours included, more and more people are accessing it through Facebook and Twitter, not going to our homepage and not going. There's still a significant audience, but it's definitely going toward social media. That's how they're getting their news. So it sort of is natural from that the comments would therefore appear where they're getting the story. And I don't think it's just one thought that occurred is I still get letters to the editor. They land on my desk. I get a pretty good stack of them. And I would say that the level of discourse there is no different, that there's a lot that, you know, some of them come there. There's one person in particular that writes weekly, daily, and it's anonymous, and it's all on the outside of
the
envelope.
I think David Andrea has posted a few pictures of the writing on the outside of the envelope, which is an interesting tactic to take.
So they know they're afraid we're not even going to open. I do open them all. I do read them all.
I would say
it's the same kind of discourse happening, on pen and paper as well, and typewriters still. I get them on typewriters. So I don't think that the level of discourse is that different just because it's online. And I would say, sometimes I would agree with Howard that sometimes the conversation is trivial. You know ahead of time in advance which stories you have to watch out for, the racist comments, those kind of comments, and we keep closer tabs on those before we even post them. We're ready. But there are some great conversations happening too. And stories without comments, to me, sometimes feel flat, that if they're not getting people to feel something and have a little bit of passion, those stories fall flat. So I really enjoy, even though I hate comments sometimes and the work it sometimes involves, I also enjoy reading them sometimes.
You're an engagement editor.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to believe in the possibility that comment sections can advance the conversation.
And, honestly, even in the short period, I've been doing this now for about a year and a half, and I see people starting to police. I see, you have your regulars there that are always there, and you know which ones you sort of have to watch out for and occasionally, hide something they've said. But I see more and more people saying, there was one yesterday about, we got a lot of comments on, it was about the fire trucks that had flags flying in the back. And you could tell which people had not actually read the story. And we leave those comments up there, but other people were saying, did you even read the story?
The best comments are for long form stories, 8,000 words and 3 minutes after they post, people are weighing in. I'm going, really? That's fabulous that you can
read it. But I have noticed more and more people trying to say, it's not even us going in and saying, this is wrong. You got this incorrect. Or you didn't read it. Clearly you didn't read it. And even people who are being rude, other people will call them out. So I'm seeing a little bit of, more so even recently, I think, than I have in the past. I think people are starting to understand if you want to have a good discussion, you have to be part of making it that way.
Especially because you guys are so large and you have, I think it's probably 200, 225 posts a week that you guys put out. There's a lot to police there. Mm-hmm. There's probably 1,500, 2,000 comments that you guys are going through, and that can be really difficult.
Well, Howard mentioned, and Julie just mentioned, and Seth has talked about the fact that they are all personally engaged in at least monitoring the kinds of comments, seeing what's there. But after this only break of the hour, I want to come back and hit the question on moderation, because a couple of people have written in to say, why would NPR do this? Why don't you just moderate it? Well, NPR addressed this in their rather lengthy article, and Megan Mack and I can make sure we post it on our Twitter feeds. If you want to read exactly what NPR said, they had multiple headings. Why are we doing this? Why are we taking down online comments? One of them is money, and money's tied to moderating. My colleague Elisa Orlando, I think very wisely, did point out that she said the tone of my comments, either in person or online, totally depends on whether or not I'm hungry. So don't ever comment on low blood sugar. But in a much more serious vein, she points out, it could be a cost-cutting move, and NPR addressed that in their article. That is part of it. So let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll talk about this idea that we'll just moderate it, do it more thoroughly, have an actual policy, do it like the New York Times Online does it. We'll talk about that, get more of your comments in. If you want to call, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, it's the summer of food on Connections, and we take a look at breakfast and cereal in particular. Multiple reports and studies show that cereal consumption is on the decline in this country. So why is that? Why are Americans, who don't want to spend a lot of time eating breakfast, eating so much less cereal? We'll try to explore that and get your habits and take on it as well next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've got Julie Phillip in studio. She's the senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. Seth Palmer, digital content manager at 13 WHAM TV. and Howard Owens, the publisher of the Batavian and the Wyoming County Free Press, on the line with us for a few more minutes before Howard's got to get out, and he's got a long work day as well. But we're talking about NPR's decision to eliminate online comments. And I mentioned earlier, we got an email from a listener who said, I'm a longtime NPR member, and that's not going to change, but I'm not on social media, and this is disappointing to me. Tim in Pittsford, here's a separate email that I found interesting, because Tim points out, I'm not an 80-year-old guy who may not have the technical expertise of a younger listener. I'm in my 30s. I see the downside of Facebook and Twitter. Tim says, the reason I go on to NPR's websites is to comment. I purposely do not have a Facebook or a Twitter account, so commenting on their websites is an easy way to state my opinion, and I really wish NPR had not done this. So, you know, maybe that's not in a majority or even a plurality, but that is a reminder that not everybody, no matter your age, is on Facebook or Twitter, which is where a lot of the conversation has gone. And Tim is saying this takes away an avenue to engage in the conversation. I want to talk about moderating, because some of our listeners have said, well, they shouldn't have done this. They should do what the New York Times does, which is good comment section, heavily moderated, heavily policed. NPR addressed this. And again, they mentioned the fact that their online comment system gets more expensive the more comments that are posted, and they just don't see an ROI. And to add full-time moderation would lead to an even bigger budget for a comment section that already is attracting a smaller crowd. So, Howard, I'll start with you. When it comes to, you know, really vigorously moderating, is it fair to think that that is an expense, and is that an expense that news organizations should be bearing?
Well, to answer the first question, the last question first, yes. Now, you know, NPR has their own budget concerns or whatever. As a general rule, I think businesses, NPR, I realize they're nonprofit, but they still operate as a business, makes business decisions, should, invest in the community, invest in conversation, and provide that platform. One reason we haven't hit on yet that I think is important. You run a general news site, all of us on the phone, DNC, 13WAM, the Batavian, Wyoming County Free Press, we're general news sites. NPR is a general news site. Facebook is essentially a collection of silos. And some of the conversation we've lost have been people going in and setting up groups just for the libertarians or just for the Republicans or just for the Democrats, because a lot of times it's hard to engage with people that you disagree with and have a civil discussion. And so people can go into their own echo chamber and have those conversations.
Sure.
And I think we don't want to abrogate our responsibility to be a general interest place for engagement for our communities.
I think that's well said. We do tend to sort of self-segregate, but then if that happens, Julie Philip, again, you're in charge with engagement for the Democrat and Chronicle. If we are pushing ourselves into our own silos and we're not engaging with people who disagree, are we getting anything out of that? Are we... You know, not to say that every conversation is about you must believe like me or you're going to convince me to believe like you, but if we're in echo chambers, we're suffering from this epistemic closure, what's the point?
Right. No, I think that it's very important to have conversations with people you disagree with and to know they're out there. And I see that happening on our DNC Facebook page, because that is a general news site. I think that there are plenty of opportunities to disagree on social media. But at the same time, it also allows you to friend who you want to friend, follow who you want to friend or follow. And you can become isolated if you don't make an effort to be diverse.
Yeah. Seth Palmer, what do you think?
Yeah. I think it's like any other mass form of social media. It's a confirmation bias. It's a chance to push yourself into a corner and put your hands over your ears if you let it. But if you expose yourself to other people's opinions that are different than yours, it's just going to be a little bit easier for you.
That's kind of our job, is to understand all the opinions out there. So maybe I tend to have a more diverse selection of Facebook following than others. But I think it's possible to still not be a silo.
Okay, well,
use social media.
Jake, one of our listeners, says the lack of teaching basic debate skills has a lot to do with the problems with online comments. What's taught as debate in high school today is a joke. We need more humanities in school. So Jake is saying we're just not good at presenting our views effectively to begin with, and that's why it just gets into name-calling and nastiness. So have you thought about that, Seth? Do you think, I mean, I don't know how much you've studied current debate teaching. I haven't studied that much, but it's an interesting point. I mean, I take Jake's point that we do devolve too quickly into pejoratives, to name-calling, all those things.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's symptomatic of a lot of things. Debate, certainly, or a lack of debate prep, I suppose you could call it, could be one thing, the way that it's taught. You know, you could name a number of other things, the way that we interact with our friends, parenting, at the collegiate level. You could go at a bunch of different directions with that, but...
My son took debate and I thought he did, I thought it was great. I think the schools do a good job.
Yeah.
I would argue that maybe our politicians don't do as well in teaching the public how to debate.
well, that's fair enough. And what I do think we don't do well is we are not teaching a value of embracing new evidence and celebrating when our mind changes. And I'm not talking about sticking your finger in the wind when you're a political leader and thinking, how many votes can I get? I'm talking about saying, wow, I was wrong. And now I view the world differently. And that's great, as opposed to never admitting that. I do think Jake has a point there. Maybe that's tied to Jake's point, that we don't teach that as a value. Howard, I know your time is short, so some final thoughts from you before you got to get out of here.
Okay, well, I thought Seth used a great term that's on point, and that's confirmation bias. I think too often we're not aware enough of our own biases, and we are too easy to dismiss why somebody else holds another opinion. And that's a lot of times why some of these arguments devolve into shouting matches, is because we're not willing to except that maybe some of our own facts are wrong, or maybe we need to have a more nuanced view instead of being so categorical. And I think, to bring it back to the topic here, is that's why I think it's important for general news organizations to have, develop the resources and hire the people and host the conversations. And try to get people engaging on our own sites where we can guide those conversations more effectively.
Howard, thanks for taking the time. Howard Owens is the publisher of The Batavian and the Wyoming County Free Press, and works very hard to continue the kind of engagement. So I do appreciate your views on this. You're easy to find, and you're always very accessible, and thanks for doing it, Howard.
Thanks, Em. Really appreciate it.
Howard Owens joining us. All right, we continue in studio with Julie Phillip from the Democrat and Chronicle, Seth Palmer from 13 Wham TV. Denise writes to the program and says, Evan, I think the one thing you and your panel are overlooking is that by becoming more restrictive in how you receive comments, you are cutting out a certain portion of the audience, senior citizens. We are a large portion of the audience, I suspect, but not nearly as social media savvy. Yeah, Denise, I mean, we're certainly trying to honor that point of view and take that in. We've heard that from a number of people today who said that they feel like this is a little bit limiting. And Bonnie in Rochester wants to weigh in as well. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, I guess a couple things. One is that I observe over recent years, meaning, a number of years, that I think NPR overall has become more conservative. And there's been, if you look at the Bill Moyers analysis that, the riff there a few years ago and how that's, continued to play out some. So it's hard to prove these things, but I think that would make me feel as part of it. I also missed, with NPR when they went to Here and Now and the national programs, there was before that, direct call-ins. I'm not saying you have to have one every single day necessarily, but I think that, it's a missing element. Because we're forgetting, there's actually sometimes fewer places for people who have more progressive views to express things than there are the other way around, given the corporate media and all that. So I think that those are two points. I would also like to add that on the current, program, the Connections program, I would like to see a return, at least maybe once every couple of weeks, to the whole 2 hours being devoted for people just calling in about subjects that concern them. I think that was always a valuable piece, and just would advocate for returning that It didn't have to be every week, but every 2 weeks. Okay, thank you.
Bonnie, thank you. I do appreciate that, and we take all feedback very seriously. We do think that this is a good place to engage. We try to do that every day on this program. So thank you, Bonnie, and thank you for the suggestions. David writes to the program and says, good point from one of your listeners on debates. Remember Firing Line? Talk about great debates. That show's probably too smart for audiences in 2016. That comes from David. Hillary writes to the program and says that she has found herself at least once scared for her safety after being in local news online comment sections. I'm sorry to hear that, Hillary. She didn't mention where that happened. Randy writes to the program and says he thinks the Democrat and Chronicle is not welcoming in its sections to conservative viewpoints. Julie Phillip?
And we also have people who say we're not welcoming to liberal viewpoints. So we've heard that many, many times.
Okay, but you want to just tell them that you think it's entirely untrue?
I'm welcome to all viewpoints, provided they follow the community rules and have a civil discussion. I enjoy reading all viewpoints.
It's not about bias. It's about behavior, you
yes.
say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Seth,
mm-hmm.
you get that claim from some people who say, hey, you're being overly harsh because I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican, I'm conservative, I'm liberal, whatever it is.
Yeah, I think any good media organization receives criticism from both sides, and that's how you know you're doing your job right. It's easy to think that you're doing something right, but not necessarily if you are continually having your like I said before, bias is confirmed by one side. So it's good to get criticism from both sides.
As Abraham Lincoln said, you can't believe everything you read on the internet, all the quotes. So I don't know where this is from. I think it was Hearst, but essentially the spirit of the comment is if you are interviewing someone in political leadership and you are not making them uncomfortable, you're just doing PR. And so, Seth, that kind of dovetails with your point that, you know, ideally, if you are going to hear from both sides who don't feel entirely comfortable with what you're doing, but that's not an aim at false equivalence. Please don't call me the false equivalence police. Don't call me and say I'm in that crowd. I'm just making an observation. John in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I heard part of the show. I email every once in a while the national NPR site, and also I think I've done it locally too, to WXXI. It's going to be eliminated? Any email comments?
No, not email. You can email NPR.
Oh, okay,
and their people.
Great.
It's their comment sections on their news site. So NPR.org will not have open comment sections on their news stories.
I gotcha. Gotcha. Because I find it very beneficial, and I email quite a bit like USA reporters,
USA Today,
Democrat,
yep.
mm-hmm. Democrat and Chronicle reporters. I think it's a really good give and take to give them a critique of some of the stories that they write, and to give them a positive critique if they write a good story.
They have your picture posted at the DNC offices, John.
With a big heart around it.
John, thank you for the phone call.
Okay.
And so, Julie, to John's point, he at least says that's one way he engages email. Do you get a lot of some people, I heard somebody say recently that very few people email anymore. Even email is becoming outdated. I don't know if that's true. How often are you engaging that way?
We do have DC Edit is our email address for comments. And we get a pretty regular flow of emails in. A lot of them are regulars. We do hear a lot from regulars. And I know the reporters get a lot of emails as well. David Andreotti gets a ton of emails. and I think it's good because it allows us an opportunity to correct misperceptions at times, to learn new information, to explain why something happened. I think emails are a really great way to express yourself other than social media. And we do try to respond to, not the DC Edit ones, because we just get too many to kind of respond to everybody. But if they email a reporter personally, that reporter, maybe not that minute because they're very busy, but they do eventually, you know, try to have a discourse with people.
John on Twitter says money spent on comment sections would be better used on reporting. I haven't read the comments there or other news sites in years. So that's just one take on it from John on Twitter. But Matt on Twitter says, note how all your Twitter replies are celebrating NPR for their decision. Proof that online comments are for those not into social media. Those opposed are not here on Twitter. So I think Matt makes a good point. He also adds, online comments are Internet 1.5. We're in Internet 2.5. Twitter was 2.0. Internet 3.0 will make even Twitter obsolete. Okay. Maybe true. I just don't know where. Where do you think we're going next, Julie?
I don't know, but I agree. We're going to go somewhere. Probably Snapchat, because that's where the kids are.
Please no. Please no.
I wouldn't say no. I mean, I half joke about that, but I definitely see us moving again. I mean, I think that that's just how life works.
You know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're still on Twitter the same way?
No, I don't think we will be. I mean, look at Facebook Live, how that's changing, what we're doing on Facebook. I mean, that we're just continually... technology is moving quickly, and I think we'll be in other places. And I hope that we will start to discover some ways to improve conversations and to have better conversations. Things like Reddit, where you can vote up and down. So when you have somebody disrupting a conversation, it can be self-police, so moderating becomes less of a problem for companies. So I think we'll be going somewhere. I don't think we're going to stay right where we are today forever. But I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball.
5 or 10 years, Twitter still doing what it's doing, Seth?
Doing it differently. Even 5 years ago, Twitter is fascinating how it's changed for me. Back when you worked at 13, I remember when I first got hired, it was one of the most exciting things was getting to tweet at you, hey, I get to come and work with you while I'm there.
I don't remember that.
And it was, ouch. No, I'm just kidding. But yeah, it's evolved tremendously since then. It used to be a lot more binary, a lot more commenting, not commenting. And now it's links, it's videos, it's a
pictures,
completely different mm-hmm. thing from what it used to be. So yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes, and I think it'll become more diversified and segmented, whether it's Snapchat or Musical.ly or any of the other wild imaginative things we come up with.
I've done some writing I've written on various platforms and sites. Wrote an online wine column monthly for an online magazine called Palette Press that used sort of just general open comments for a while and got a lot of comments and then changed to Discus. And I actually thought that made it a little more obstreperous. Mm-hmm. It was harder for me even to get in to respond to people who were commenting on stories I had written. But I see it in a lot of places. How do you like that as a platform?
I think it's a little obtrusive just because you have to go through a couple of an extra set of steps to get in there. And in this day and age is... You know, we try to make things more simplistic and just keep it, you know, one step, two steps. It makes it more difficult for people to get in. And unfortunately, I think that inhibits the conversation.
Yeah, I don't disagree, because I think just empirically, you cannot argue with the fact that it does. But Seth, some people would say, well, that's good because you don't want the drive-by trolls just to jump in and leave their
but
bilge.
I don't think trolls are drive-by. I think trolls are the ones
that
will go
through. Intentional.
Yes, yes.
Very intentional.
We have some, I think that's what they do all day, because there'll be posts frequently all day long, the same people. So apparently they have really great employers or they're retired.
Well, as a regular listener of this program mentioned, you know, there are some, you go to some comment sections and sometimes people don't even identify themselves by name, as we've talked about. Some still allow anonymous comments, but some people will say, well, I'm a small business owner. And a friend of mine said, all of those small business owning anonymous trolls could be large business owners if they got off these comment sections all day.
They really are committed. So I'm not sure that the extra steps would solve the, you know, difficult problems.
Okay. So to kind of put a bow on this, a lot of different viewpoints on what NPR has decided to do. And again, before you draw any more conclusions, if you want to read more of what NPR said about why, I give them a lot of credit. They posted a lengthy article by Elizabeth Jensen and NPR website to get rid of comments. It's got a lot of comments from people within NPR. It's got a lot of comments from listeners on all sides of it. And we've posted that on our Twitter feeds. But it sounds like at least Julie and Seth say they may not have made the same decision, but, you know, you can understand where NPR is going. And do you view this, Julie, as NPR trying to stamp out interaction?
No, I think they probably are stamping out some, as we've heard from some listeners. We do still, even though 3% of comments happen on our site, they're still there. And as far as I know,
and
there's
3%
been still, no
that's
discussion.
Still a lot of comments mm-hmm. on an annual basis.
Yeah, yeah. And there's been no discussion of clamping down on that. And, I, it doesn't make a huge difference to us because 97% are happening elsewhere, and we're still monitoring those. So an extra 3% is, you know, on our site doesn't. So I guess I understand NPR's position, but I don't know. I haven't looked at their finances or anything, but I do. It makes me a little sad
okay.
that they did that.
Seth, some quick thoughts from you, about 20 seconds.
It makes me a little sad, but I understand it as a business decision, which sounds like it's just a terrible sentence to say aloud.
Because people roll their eyes at news talking about business, but, you know, there are bottom lines in the world.
Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunate. But, you know, it does allow the opportunity for new areas of growth and new niche markets that you can serve. And there's always the phone and there's always email. Mm-hmm.
Seth Palmer is digital content manager at 13WAM. He's easy to find, himself and his company online. Thank you for being here. Great to see you here in studio, sir.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Julie Phillips, senior engagement editor for the Democrat and Chronicle. I suspect we'll have more to say on various issues going forward. Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And thanks to Howard Owens, the publisher of The Batavian, for also joining the conversation earlier this hour. And to you as well. Always great to have interaction on a wide range of subjects. Speaking of, it's the summer of food on Connections. Who is trying to kill cereal? Do you still eat cereal? The decline of cereal next hour.